Next up. It's a Mac. He's got the slide set. He's got this. No, it's loaded. He's got it. It's on the Mac, so where would it be? And show? No, no, no. You loaded it onto that computer, right? Oh, oh, oh.
Do you have a USB? I don't know what's up. Which one's that?
I don't know. High yield encounters. Where would it be? Hold on. High yield sexual managing screenshot. I can't even get this to work. You got another thumb drive, I can load it on. It's a Mac. Well, but it's just a thumb drive. And that one didn't work.
Didn't work?
Well, yeah, my personal one. So, like, the PSAV guy had one. We used that one. And I thought he was going to leave it here, but he took it with him or something. I just tried calling him.
Does anybody got a USB on I can borrow? Just a USB.
You just need a USB drive.
Yeah. Oh, no, the USB drive. You know what I'm talking about? I've got the adapter.
You mean a thumb drive?
A thumb drive, you got it. Aren't you? Thank you. Have I got my computer? Yeah. Yeah, man.
Just email it to me.
No, I can go right here.
Oh, okay.
There it is.
All right, so jumping in. That's what we do in ER.
So you're going to go next.
We got a paper clip, a rubber band, and a strong arm, so we're going to vent this patient. We're going to be talking about sickle cell disease pretty quickly. I actually love this topic, and I stole it from my colleague, Dr. Dark, who had to step out. So my purpose today, I'm not specifically going to, well, definitely cover evidence, but my goal is actually to make us think a little bit about what we do and why we do what we do to kind of improve the care for sickle cell patients. So very briefly, Tyson Pillow. Born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri, got as quickly as I could. I'm down in Houston now, enjoying Hawaii with the family. So I am at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. I'm a vice chair of education, been the clerkship director, program director, all that stuff. So I particularly love this topic because it's not just the evidence, it's also a lot of our biases. It's a lot of thinking about how we implement the evidence as best we can, and a little bit as to why we do or don't have good evidence about it. I have no financial disclosures. I have a 4-year-old, a 7-year-old. I will give you my money to go make more money. Please, help me, help me. But we can cover that later as well. Objectives, discuss best practices for managing sickle cell disease and common pitfalls and biases. And that's going to be a big thing. Again, I think we have a sense of what we should do, why we should do it, but thinking about why it is that we fall short from our care of sickle cell patients specifically. Problem number one, sickle cell disease directly stimulates many of our biases in medicine, right? And so I'm going to do a little bit of an experiment with everybody. So clear your mind of sickle cell disease for a second. We're actually just going to think of, let's see if this works or not. Okay, good. It actually worked. Let's see if it unworks. Oh, I think I messed it up. I'm figuring it out. Okay, clear your mind of sickle cell disease for a second. And I actually want you to think about, back pain. All right? So raise your hand when I tell you enough information that you would treat this patient with narcotics for their back pain. 50-year-old male comes in, not well known to your facility. He's asking for the D one because the other one doesn't work. He's allergic to everything else. His back really hurts. He's able to follow you to tell you his back hurts because you need to give him pain medicine. Anybody giving this guy? He has no MRI, no other imaging. Your staff doesn't recognize him. You don't recognize him. Anybody giving this guy pain medicine? Who's bold out there? All right. Then you find out he's under the wrong MRN. He actually has metastatic cancer and is under treatment. Who's treating him now? Absolutely, right? So why is that? Why is this patient that came in that had that classic tag of searching for narcotics then triggers once we start to say cancer, right? And thank you for those of you that were able to sort of be honest and to say, yes, this would trigger. It's because we have a lot of biases we actually have to actively manage in EM, as well as making sure we manage that line of heuristics versus implicit bias that negatively affect the patient, right? So sickle cell, to me, I actually teach about a lot of different cognitive biases at this point in my life. I heard my colleague, Dr. Dark, had a great talk on it recently. I'm going to glean some things from our colleague who taught us a little bit more about pain management as well as we talk about this. Sickle cell, to me, is one of the great measures of whether or not we have thought through our biases and our care, these patients, because they absolutely come in with a need for pain medicine, acute versus chronic. You can argue that many of these patients are at some level addicted to pain medications and absolutely have a disease where the life expectancy is lower than normal because of horrible, horrible chronic sickling, inflammation, inflammatory state, chronic disease, pulmonary hypertension, right? So it is where the science meets all of our biases. So we're going to talk about that very, very directly. So from that emergency standpoint, right, we love emergencies. We don't like non-emergencies. Pretty straightforward, right? That was worth the price of admission right there, for the summary. We love emergencies. We don't like non-emergencies. When that sickle cell patient comes in, we're actively trying to figure out, do they have active disease or not? And we're applying, and you should be completely comfortable about this, at some point in our existence, being able to identify the weird pattern among the bushes saved our lives. Being able to identify the mushroom that was poisonous versus the one that wasn't saved our lives. We absolutely thin slice. We absolutely make quick decisions, right? And it's actively managing that in the context of sickle cell disease to make sure we're treating these patients actively and adequately for all their presentations, right? So when we see a patient, we absolutely start to make decisions. The trick is to also balance that with evidence and be cognizant as much as possible, try to take our unconscious, bring it to the conscious, And then also make heuristics, make practice guidelines for ourselves that help manage it. What is this patient's primary complaint? Say it loud. Come on, you're tagged now.
I said she needs a hairstylist.
Definitely needs a stylist. So how many people would say she's probably coming with belly pain? Chest pain? Psychiatric complaint. Yeah. I appreciate the 8 of you that are being honest with me right now. I appreciate it. The other, what about 42 of you? What's that? I was trying a Twitter challenge. So we absolutely do this, and it's okay that we do this. I think in a lot of literature you say, oh, don't have biases. If you have biases, you're a horrible person. We all thin slice, especially in emergency medicine. We get good at figuring out that weird smell, right? Especially the closer you are to a board's exam, right? You enter the room and you smell the fresh lilac across a summer field. Like that's some poisoning or something, right? It's absolutely normal to have these biases. We just have to manage them, right? And we know this, racial. We treat patients different because of their race. Many sickle cell patients are African American, Mediterranean descent. We have to actively deal with that. Gender, age, attire, triage queuing, right? When they get triaged to urgent care, they cannot have a deadly disease. It is impossible. Urgent care has a magic screen that takes out all dissections, right? We know that's not true, so you have to keep this in mind. So this is part of who we are, this is part of what we deal with, and we're trying to be active. So what does this trigger for us? What does this trigger for us? It's a sickle cell talk. That doesn't mean it's a picture about sickle cell patient. I know you have thoughts. I can hear them. Potentially homeless. Potentially mental health. Some people say he's well put together. If this is Louisiana, be like, standard dude on the street. Right? Again, this is natural. This is what we do. We just have to actively manage. So again, I'm doing a sickle cell talk, and the first at least 5-7 minutes has actually been about managing biases. And we're going to talk about why that's important. Because we absolutely know that that factors into our care. So, sickle trait to SS disease. We got sickle beta thal, S beta thal, SC. Can sickle trait have crises? Maybe. We're kind of out there on that. Right? If they actually have derangements, yes. Most sickle trait does not have disease. To SC disease, to S beta thal, all the way to SS disease. When a patient comes in, I mean, again, I'm asking your practice, make sure we think about this actually. Patient comes in and they say, I have sickle cell disease and I'm in pain. You do not have a hemoglobin electrophoresis to verify. What do we do with those patients? We're accepting what they say when they first come in. Absolutely. How does that make us feel? Are we being honest with each other yet or not? Has anyone been lied to before? I'm an emergency physician. I've been practicing for 12 years. Some of you longer than me. Most of you longer than me. Anybody like being lied to? Anybody been lied to? Are we pretending that no one lies to us? It's incredibly hard. It's incredibly hard to be lied to and then have to see the next person, right? What's really interesting, I have stories. I trained at University of Chicago where we saw probably 3 or 4 sickle cell patients per shift, had a dedicated sickle cell team. I was part of that team. One of my publications in the literature is actually about a high utilizer intervention that we did. Many of those patients were sickle cell patients. Very familiar with this population and their care. And it's very frustrating. Anybody been spit in the face by a patient? Absolutely. Screaming for pain medicine? screaming for whatever. So there's also psychological burden in this process as well. I think we have to be very, very cognizant of that. And then on the other side, we absolutely know. It's not quite as simple as cells sickle, and then it doesn't perfuse, and then bad. Not quite as simple as that. Probably closer to chronic inflammatory state, micro-infarcts, hyperperfusion, chronic disease, pulmonary hypertension. I'm going to ask this a little bit later, but we're going to ask, I got a little bit of evidence. I might actually have it coming up. So we know it's a horrible, horrible disease. Anybody know what this is an image of? This struck me one of the first times I actually realized this as far as a systemic level. So these are the H-shaped vertebrae associated with chronic microinfarcts of the bone in sickle cell patients. We all learn this in association with the pain crises. I think the thing to realize is anyone know, you yourself, I want to definitely be respectful, you yourself or know anybody with sickle cell disease? Have you ever talked to a patient, how often do sickle cell patients have pain? All the time. All the time, right? So think about that. What we've been trained on, what we've been taught to focus on are the pain crises. What we're actually dealing with is a disease process that has a huge, huge morbidity and mortality. Until hydroxyurea, death rate before 18 was ridiculous. 33%, I think it was. Right? Once we got hydroxyurea, then the transition from pediatric to adult care became the place where many of them started to have problems. And you saw it with cancer. When I started with back pain, didn't want to treat the patient, we found out he had cancer. There were some people that then said they want to treat the cancer. If we recognized and stopped ourselves and thought about this management of the sickle cell patient population, we'd realize they're dealing with this horrible chronic disease. And I think that would help improve our care. What is the life expectancy of a sickle cell patient currently? Y'all happen to know? We have just been able to improve recently, I say recently in the last 20 years or so. If you saw a patient in their 50s with sickle cell 10 years ago, that was a miracle. They probably didn't have pure SS disease. They might have had SC or S beta thal. Now life expectancy is somewhere in the 52, 54 range. Before, for a long, long time, was in the 40s. So again, a disease we know leads to increased morbidity and mortality. We know causes a lot of active biases, and we have to manage that. This is why I call sickle cell patients, why I love talking about it, because it's not just the evidence, but it's also how we interact with this patient, how we actually think about our biases in the care of these patients, right? So we're still here. And again, I believe my colleague, Dr. Dark, started to cover some of these. We're still here where we know we have these implicit biases. And again, one of the big messages I want you to take home is that this is normal. This is normal. We've been lied to. We've been spit upon. We've been hit. Anybody been hit in the emergency department? Right? Stabbed? Shot? I have a colleague who's been stabbed, actually had to have neck exploration because one of the patients lunged at him, right? So that's our life. So it's perfectly normal to be wary, right? When the patient comes in and asks for the pain medication by name and has associated allergies with all other medications except that medication, it is okay to be upset, but we still need to actively realize these cognitive errors are contributing to our care and treat the patients the best we can, right? So I ask this very commonly of my residents and my colleagues when I go speak about this. So for example, thinking about those understanding the disease process, but also thinking about our biases, you get a patient, you get an x-ray, and they have a little schmutz on their x-ray. This is a trick question. This is a trick question. Maybe you don't know me. I love trick questions. Is this pneumonia? If it is pneumonia, do you think it's bacterial, viral? Or is it acute chest syndrome? They do have sickle cell disease. That man's been spit on. As we all have. Okay. What does correlate clinically mean? Agreed. What does that mean? Great. Great point. Do they have an oxygenation requirement? You said something? Pain in the chest? The answer, so yes, those are correct statements. And the answer is yes. Yes, it could be pneumonia. Not acute chest, but pneumonia can precipitate acute chest. Yes, it could be acute chest by itself without necessarily underlying pneumonia. And in these cases, we have to assume, we know how bad this disease process is. We know we have these biases. We have to assume they're sick. I think a lot of times we wait until they're sick enough to get rid of our doubt before we start down the route of treatment, right? And definitely we see that in the literature as far as race, gender, and I would argue very few places do we see that play out in real disease than we do with sickle cell patients. All right. I had a colleague come up to me. She was taking care of, our center doesn't see too many sickle cell patients, so we're a little bit less familiar. Had a colleague who was taking care of a patient, came in, white count of 20-something, but otherwise looked good, called hematology. Respectfully, they said, doesn't need exchange transfusion, transferred him out. I said, oh, wow, you must be telling me about some other patient. Something happened. He died. What happened to him? And she looked at me with a frightened face. I said, hey, a sickle cell patient, oxygenating well or not, why count 25, you got to assume he's going to try to die. He's actively doing it in front of you. And it turns out, unfortunately, that this patient did, on transfer, get decompensate and die. We wait in certain disease processes, even though we know the severity. We know that this is a lifelong process that leads to increased morbidity and mortality. Sickle cell, I would argue more than other diseases, but that's maybe my bias because I'm talking about it right now. But sickle cell is a horrible, horrible disease. We have to check our biases at the door. We have to be active. I'm going to give you a punchline now for later. If you don't actively have a sickle cell management team at your institution, you should probably be admitting most of your sickle cell patients every single time they come in. That's a little bit of exaggeration. We could discuss it and figure out what works for your practice and where you're at. And as I'll mention, the evidence is a little bit lacking overall. But these patients are sick. Unfortunately, they lie to us, right? They lie about their disease, how sick they are, their allergies, etc. At University of Chicago, we had a patient. This is a famous story. I don't know how true it is or not. I have a version of that in Houston, not as dramatic. We had the sickle cell patient that everyone loved. 40-something-year-old black female comes in, nice to all the staff, always gets her two rounds and goes home, never wants to be admitted, tells you about her family, has pictures, whole nine yards. Come to find out, on one of her visits, leaves behind her book, and there is some active process of hospital jumping to make sure she can get medication without showing up to a single hospital too many times. So think about that. At least from the patient perspective, our care of this patient was at least questionable enough that she had to actively plan to make sure she didn't create any stigma against her, any bias against her, right? That's a failure on our part. That's a failure on our part. And I want to be active in talking about that, right? The next pearl, pain management may be the opposite of our normal approaches. And I'm going to take the things we learned from our colleague and amend some of these things actively, which is great. Did anybody else learn to judge pain in med school, in residency? So what do I mean by that? We rate pain, right? We rate pain. It's part of the billing. It's part of understanding how severe it is. When do we learn to judge pain? If someone says 1 out of 10 pain, do they get pain medicine? No, that's just a 1. Right? I've got indigestion right now. I'm at a 1. Right? If they say 10 out of 10 and they aren't appropriately answering questions, complying with our triage, complying with the exam, and or otherwise don't convince us it's real pain, do they get pain medicine? No. So somewhere in this process, we learn to judge pain as well. Right? And I hope I don't get myself in trouble. I mean this completely respectfully. Women are tougher than men. I am married to an ER nurse. Our pain tolerance is different. Right? My wife, during her regular menstrual, is able to take care of our entire household and not blink. I stubbed my toe last week. I cried. So her 10 and my 10 are different, just two different people. Her 10 and my 10 are different. When did we learn to judge pain? And unfortunately, with that judgment, we assume addiction. This is something that gets talked about. So I've had the pleasure of presenting at conferences that focus on sickle cell disease and had the chance to talk to experts in the field, both who have sickle cell themselves and who do not. And one of the things that comes across is because they have pain every day, to varying degrees, there is usually some sort of use of pain medication every day. I'm not going to sit up here and say every person with sickle cell disease is addicted to pain medicine. But if you had daily chronic pain, I would expect some pain management is part of your daily life. Right? We assume, right? What is a good patient who comes in for pain medicine? How many times, I'm being completely serious, we got to explore our biases while we're doing this. How many times can a patient ask for pain medicine before you think they're faking? Be honest. Just one over here. Sure, they broke an arm. Even when they broke an arm. How many times? I already gave you X. Why you keep bothering me? Get as much as you want to break your arm. You get a lot more when you have cancer, too. 3 is my number. As I was looking at myself, thinking about my biases, 3 is my number, right? How many times can you ask, even with legit pain, before it starts to trigger us, right? So we think they're addicted. And this was covered, so I'll skip that point. I think the other thing that happens is that these patients, unless you have protocols for pain medication at the door, these patients sit there and don't get adequate pain treatment, don't get adequate analgesia for hours. And then how dare you ask for a redose anywhere before 4 hours? How dare you assume that my adequately dosed 2 of morphine for your 100 kilo, well, they're not usually 100 kilos, but for your 70 kilos is inadequate, right? So we absolutely have to think about that pain management. What's really interesting, looking at the literature, we don't know. We don't know. This was a very interesting review. I had a chance to look through the Kaken database. Essentially, it said, we don't know. If you would like to read the article, I think it's a nice read. We don't have enough randomized controlled trials. We don't have enough comparison studies. We don't have enough evidence to even tell what's harmful, what's not. We don't know. There's some thought, that actually avoiding NSAIDs is a thing to do in sickle cell disease because these patients can have supernormal proximal tubule function. So even at high normal creatinines, their kidney function is actually depressed. And we know they have microinfarcts of their kidney long term.
So avoid all incest altogether. We don't have any evidence of that. That's just theoretical, right? What I can tell you is very briefly skimming the literature on pain medicine, we know we undertreat pain. And so from a standpoint of practicality, we want to be more aggressive with the pain management for our sickle cell patients. Third big thing, sickle cell disease is still relatively understudied compared to other diseases. Okay. Came across this while I was researching for the topic. If you looked up asthma, PubMed, how many articles are you finding? 120, 140,000, I think was the number. You look up CHF, how many articles are you finding? 150 plus, 160. Most of them written by Frank Peacock for a weird reason. If you look up sickle cell, how many articles do you think we're finding? 20,000. By itself, a big number compared to other severe disease processes, interestingly, comparatively low. We don't know. So my message today is not only think about your biases, be aggressive with your pain management, it's also understand we don't know. So we do have to try to do our best to manage them, these patients the best we can with the medications we have. Anybody prescribe hydroxyurea from the ED? They run out. They absolutely run out. Has anyone ever prescribed hydroxyurea from the ED for sickle cell patients? Absolutely. I could go into my philosophy about prescribing, re-prescribing, restarting, stopping psychiatric medications. So absolutely, there are times where I restart, times where I don't, times I don't touch it, times I say. Hydroxyurea is one of the most important, if not the most important medication that we manage our sickle cell patients with. You should get comfortable assessing that they are taking their medications and refilling it from the ED, because that intervention, I can't prove it because, as we mentioned, there's not as much literature. That intervention is incredibly important for their management. Incredibly important for their management. Okay. Otherwise, my take home today is actually to go find this article. It's actually a nice summary. Not quite up to date, being about 4 years old, but there's not much literature to add. About thinking about these sickle cell patients. Big take homes. Again, I'm sorry I can't prove it, but we think this matters. Big take homes we think matter. Use the best evidence and involve a multidisciplinary team. Those big take homes. Hydroxyurea for everyone. If they run out, get comfortable giving it. Don't forget the retic count as a measure of aplastic anemia, potentially, in those patients. Isotonic bolus versus hypotonic maintenance. So in general, it's okay when bolusing a patient. We still go with our isotonic fluids. But once you're in the maintenance phase, switch to something half normal saline or even just thinking about that sodium load on these patients. You don't have to flood them with fluids. Exchange transfusion is frequently the answer. And why do I say that? In the literature, even your hematologist will disagree when you transfuse and when you don't. And the priapism literature, even there in sickle cell patients, when do you transfuse, when don't you? Right? So there's still a lot of questions. But the reason I say that is to prepare. If you know that the patient might be sick, exchange transfusion might be in their future, make sure you're getting that type and screen and preparing for it. If you're at a facility, you can't exchange transfuse quickly. Simple transfusions can help you. Okay. And then consult your neighborhood hematologist early and often. I think one of the biggest take-homes to realize is that patient in front of you, everything that was said was correct. Hypoxia is bad, ultimate mental status is bad, all that good stuff. That patient in front of you may look perfectly fine as they're cascading towards death, okay? So being very, very active from that standpoint, all right? So that was it for me. Short, sweet, to the point. At the end of the day, a lot of our management of sickle cell patients, because we don't have a lot of evidence, we're doing the best we can. But a lot of it is realizing and checking our biases at the door, thinking about the heuristics, thinking about the systems that allow us to take active, aggressive care of these patients, and understanding that many of the things we deal with, you know, particularly that idea of you've got to deserve pain medicine for me, that's actually leading to worse care for these patients. Okay. With that, thank you very much for taking the time to listen to me. I'll take any questions very quickly, but otherwise, I believe it's break time. Sir? I used to. I currently don't. And the theory is just very simply, there may be harm, and I can probably get to the benefit of adequate analgesia without them. I also have sometimes toyed with the idea of low-dose ketamine as well, which has not, to my knowledge, has not been studied very much in sickle cell disease. So I move towards the other thing. Now, I could be exactly right. I could be completely wrong. You don't know, so you just try to make your best judgment from there. We absolutely know, just like the pulmonary hypertension, it's just part of chronic disease in sickle cell. We absolutely know that microinfarcts of the kidney and kidney dysfunction is part of the path. All right, thank you all very much.